From Greenville to Danville, Gettysburg to Altoona, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, America sits atop vast energy resources, and the Trump administration is putting into place policies that will allow us to develop those resources. Stephanie Wissman from the American Petroleum Institute, Pennsylvania, is here with details. U.S. Senator Rand Paul continues fighting to determine the real origin of the COVID-19 virus. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets an update on his efforts. And Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, has this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary on leading through the principles of conservatism. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Stephanie Wissman from the American Petroleum Institute in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Historically, retention elections for statewide courts have been virtually ignored by politicians and the electorate at large. Justices of the state Supreme Court, along with judges on the Commonwealth and Superior Courts, stand every 10 years for a simple yes or no vote on whether they should continue to serve. In the history of Pennsylvania's statewide judiciary, only one Supreme Court justice failed to be retained, and that occurred during a major public uproar over pay increases approved by the state legislature. This year looks to be far different. Three Democratic state Supreme Court justices who have been highly activist and partisan in their rulings are up for retention, and Republicans look to defeat them in the retention vote. But the left, notably labor unions, are looking to pour tens of millions of dollars into the campaign. The result is going to be a highly competitive retention election, something not seen before in Penn's Woods. A vote was taken in the U.S. Senate this past week on legislation to protect women and girls from being forced to compete against biological males in sports. Despite polling showing an overwhelming majority of Americans support a ban on men participating in women's sports, the U.S. Senate failed to advance the bill. All Democrat senators, including Pennsylvania's John Fetterman, voted against protecting women in sports. While the bill did achieve a majority of votes, it did not receive the 60 votes needed in the Senate to advance. U.S. Senator Dave McCormick voted with his fellow Republicans in support of protecting women in sports. Elon Musk and the newly created Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, have made great progress in rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal bureaucracy. Now, two Pennsylvania state senators want the Commonwealth to follow that lead. State Senator Kristen Phillips Hill of York County has introduced a bill to create an office to review the more than 162,000 state regulations now on the books. State Senator Doug Mastriano of Franklin County is proposing a bipartisan oversight committee to review spending. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Biden administration policies were hostile to the development of America's energy resources, but the Trump administration is changing that. Will Pennsylvania follow suit? Stephanie Wissman is executive director of the Pennsylvania chapter of the American Petroleum Institute. She joins us now to discuss Pennsylvania's energy future. Stephanie, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Stephanie, the American Petroleum Institute, you have a five-point policy roadmap. This is for federal energy policy, but it also relates to what we're doing here in the Commonwealth. Can you talk a bit about those 5 points?
Absolutely. And just leading right into that, I would say energy was on the ballot last year during the elections, and Pennsylvania made 2024 an energy election. And guess what, Loman? Energy won. So you look at the scale of America's energy need, it is so great, and we have an opportunity to power that future. And here's a couple stats for you in the audience, which is really staggering when you think about it. So U.S. electricity demand has grown by 2.5% over the last 7 years, but now over the next 7 years, it's projected to grow 25%. So we're going from 2.5% to 25% of electricity demand. And you hear a lot about artificial intelligence and just the strain on the power grid. So if we want to keep the bulk of AI on American soil, we're going to have to dedicate about 51 gigawatts, which is that's roughly equivalent to all the power the entire state of California produces in a year. So our next chapter of our energy future begins right now, and the United States can and will meet the moment. And we're looking to the new administration and Congress to focus on securing our energy leadership, because we know, you know, the status quo is not going to cut it. And bringing it back to Pennsylvania, natural gas development is foundational to our economy, and it must be a top priority to meeting our increasing energy needs. The American Petroleum Institute is based in Washington, D.C., and our president and CEO, Mike Summers, gives a state of the state on exactly what is the state of American energy, specifically focusing in on natural gas and oil. And the main bottom line point is the election made it clear that energy was on the ballot and the American energy won. So you take a look at that. So right now this is the American energy opportunity to advance common sense energy policies. So we're asking the administration and Congress that, you know, let's seize this opportunity. So when you take a look at our 5-point policy roadmap, these are the suggestions that we have, the policy points that we have put forth to the administration and Congress on how we can seize this energy opportunity. And one is protecting consumer choice. And what that means is government should not be telling Americans which cars to drive. So this is the electric vehicle mandate, if you will. Electric vehicles are fine. They're an option for some, but they don't work for all Americans. And the existing charging infrastructure as well is completely inadequate to meet the mandated targets. So what we're saying is government should not be telling us what to do in that area. So that's number one. Number two is making sure we can bolster our geopolitical strength. And what I'm talking specifically about here is the opportunity for liquefied natural gas exports. So nowhere is the value of energy as geopolitical strength clearer than it is through U.S. LNG. So by increasing liquefied natural gas to our allies abroad, the third point is we need to leverage our natural resources. Energy production benefits every region of the country, including right here in Pennsylvania. But unfortunately, you know, the previous administration impeded that resource development. And that included, they implemented the weakest offshore leasing program in history. So this year, just as something to point to, this year the U.S. didn't have an offshore lease sale for the first time since 1966. So a pro-American energy approach is sorely needed to initiate this new era of federal energy leasing. So we absolutely need to have more access to these precious resources. Fourth, and something you hear about a lot, is the need to reform our permitting system. And that's not only at the national level, but at the state level. So we need smart, comprehensive permitting reform, and to make sure that our companies, they ensure that we have transparency and predictability and timeliness and durability. The permitting process has been weaponized, unfortunately, by opponents of energy progress, and they try to stop these projects before they even start. So we need that reform to ensure that we can build the infrastructure needed for today and the future. And then fifth, certainly not least, last but not least, is that we need to advance sensible tax policy. You know, the U.S. natural gas and oil industry, we support nearly 11 million jobs in this country, and we're responsible for billions of dollars of domestic investment in 2025. But capital flows where capital is welcome, and the U.S. tax policy's got to be competitive with other countries.
We are talking with Stephanie Wissman, who is executive director of the American Petroleum Institute's Pennsylvania chapter, about U.S. energy policy. And interesting you mentioned, Stephanie, that capital goes where capital's welcome. With the new administration in Washington, obviously now we have an energy-friendly federal administration, but then there's competition among the 50 states. So where does Pennsylvania stand in that competition?
You make a great point with that. We are extremely competitive, being the number two natural gas producing state in the country. So we've got that as an advantage right here. And in Pennsylvania, we've become an energy powerhouse, and a lot of that has to do with natural gas going into the generation space, generating energy from natural gas. And a little factoid as well, that natural gas developed here provides more than half of the state's electricity generation. So it's quite a bit of the energy portfolio here. And we are also, because of natural gas, we are the number one exporter of energy in the United States, just in general, because we have such a vast amount of energy across all energy sources here in Pennsylvania. So, yeah, so as far as how we stack up with other states, I know just with bordering states like West Virginia and Ohio, perfect examples. I mean, West Virginia has made it known that they are coming for Pennsylvania. They want the jobs. They want the economic development. So they're going to do everything they possibly can to get companies to locate there, for families to live there. I mean, that's very important to them. And they are actually going to take a look at all their surrounding states to see how does West Virginia stack up against these surrounding states when it comes to regulations and ease of getting permits to build a facility and create jobs.
And of course, we have this Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGGIE, sort of hanging over our heads like the sword of Damocles here, Stephanie. And as a result, we've had some of our coal-fired power plants shutting down. Yet you mentioned earlier a dramatic increase in the demand and soon-to-be future demand for electricity. What does this do for the dependability of the grid? Are we going to be generating enough electricity to power our needs?
Yeah, and that's a great question. I mean, because that is definitely an issue right now. I mean, PJM, which is the regional grid operator, they've been sounding the bell on this for quite a while, probably for the last couple of years. And in a recent report that was out by PJM, shows the challenge of meeting the growing demand for power due in large part from the data centers and electrification, all that strain that is anticipated to be put on the electric grid. And for your listeners, so they understand, PJM is the country's largest regional transmission organization. So it operates the electric grid and coordinates the movement of wholesale electricity in all or parts of 13 states, including Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C. And the report also points out that as demand growth and requirements on thermal resources such as natural gas, coal, and oil are accelerating faster than the pace of development and deployment of these new resources, and it could result in a shortfall in supply by 2030. So it's definitely something that's top of mind. And as far as API is concerned, as the United States' leading fuel for power generation, natural gas is absolutely critically important to not only powering our homes and our businesses and manufacturing, but also data centers that I mentioned before that support advancements in technology and AI. So using natural gas for power generation has helped the U.S. achieve the largest decline in carbon dioxide emissions since 2005. So after a decade of relatively flat electricity demand, as I was mentioning earlier, America is seeing an acceleration in load growth in new data centers, manufacturing facilities, and electrification efforts. So what we're saying is that, hey, Pennsylvania is natural gas rich. We are in a very enviable position.
Governor Josh Shapiro has floated the idea of removing Pennsylvania from that PJM grid that you referenced here, Stephanie, because Pennsylvania is a net exporter of energy, of electrical energy. Is that something that's even possible to do?
Yeah, well, I know the governor cannot unilaterally remove Pennsylvania from PJM. That is something that the individual utility companies, energy utility companies, would have to decide. And they would have to petition both FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, as well as the Public Utility Commission in doing that. And that would be pretty costly as well for companies to remove themselves from the PJM. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different factors there. But bottom line is that the governor cannot unilaterally do that.
So the bottom line actually is we need to develop our energy resources, and spearheading that effort is the American Petroleum Institute. We have been talking with their Pennsylvania Executive Director, Stephanie Wissman. Stephanie, tell us a bit more about API, and you put out a lot of information here. I'm assuming most of that's available on the web, so where can they find that?
Sure. So the American Petroleum Institute is the only national trade organization that represents all segments of the natural gas and oil industry. So that includes the production side, exploration and production of natural gas and oil, companies involved in that space, as well as the midstream side, which is your transportation of that energy source, predominantly pipelines, downstream, which is your thinking about your traditional refining segments, so refining of crude oil into gasoline, distillate, et cetera, as well as petrochemical complexes that take the derivatives of natural gas and oil and convert them into building blocks for products that we use every day. And we've been around as an organization for over 100 years. And while we are advocates on behalf of our 600 member companies nationwide, we were actually founded as a standard-setting organization to the industry. We maintain, the Institute maintains 800 standards and recommended practices for virtually every facet of the industry. And you can find out more about API on our website, which is at www.api.org, as well as on social media on Twitter X at the handle at API Pena, P-E-N-N-A. And we have a Facebook page, American Petroleum Institute, Pennsylvania.
Stephanie Wissman of the American Petroleum Institute. Stephanie, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Loman. It's a pleasure being here.
The exact origin of the COVID-19 virus remains a topic of dispute. U.S. Senator Rand Paul has been working to get to the real cause of the pandemic. He talks now with Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
Hi, folks. Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine here. Thanks for joining us. If you joined us last week, you heard part one of my interview with Senator Rand Paul, where I talked to the senator about what I think has been the most exciting, the most attention-grabbing part of the new Trump administration, and that is the DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, Elon Musk's attempt to disrupt and slash government spending, and the administrative state. And if you missed that conversation, then you should go back to last week's program and you should check it out. This week, in part two of my interview with Senator Rand Paul, we covered two other topics, trade policy and his ongoing investigation into the origins of COVID-19. Both very important topics, and we're going to jump back into those now. And we once again welcome Senator Rand Paul to the program. Now, look, Senator, of course, the Trump administration, any presidential administration has, at this point, huge powers over trade policy, thanks to decades of Congress kind of offloading that responsibility. Trump has threatened tariffs on, I think just about everybody at this point, Canada, Mexico, Europe, various products from all around the world. And he's in the process of trying to put together what he's calling reciprocal tariffs, though it's a little bit unclear what that means. So let's just cut right to the chase here. Should the president have the ability, as he apparently does, to just wave his magic wand and essentially raise taxes on all the imports that come into the United States?
No. I mean, the Constitution is pretty clear that taxes are supposed to be raised by Congress and ultimately signed by the president, and it's supposed to originate in the House. I don't know how we got away from, not only does it not originate in the House, it doesn't even originate in Congress. He's able to do it with a stroke of the pen. So I believe this is wrong. I have a bill that's introduced that's called No Taxation Without Representation. We fought the revolution over it, and we really shouldn't be allowing taxes on vast swaths of our economy without a vote of Congress. I think if you tax something, you'll get less of it. It's interesting that most Republicans will tell you they're not for raising taxes, and then they're for raising taxes on trade. It comes from a misconception that trade is not mutually beneficial. They think that somehow trade is benefiting one side at the expense of the other. And that's just frankly not true. All trade is voluntary. That's what a trade is. If it's not voluntary, it's not a trade. So if I buy furniture from you and I give you $2,000 for it, you want my $2,000 more than you want your furniture, and I want your furniture more than I want my $2,000. And so we make a trade, and we both think we won, or we won't make the trade. It's mutually beneficial. Trade with foreign countries is the same. So when people talk about trade deficits, it's kind of like, well, what about your trade deficit with giant grocery store? Well, mine's enormous. Every year I spend like $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year on food, and they never buy anything from me. So my trade deficit with the grocery store is enormous, but it means absolutely nothing. But I think it's a dangerous thing to put on tariffs, particularly now when we still have pretty persistent inflation.
One of the other things that Trump has talked about is using tariffs to potentially offset income taxes, maybe in whole or in part. I mean, I know the math kind of doesn't work on that, but even if you did it as a partial offset, is that something that you and your Senate colleagues would be open to looking at as part of or independent from the big tax bill that has to get done at some point this year?
it's not going to be discussed or even offered. It's great rhetoric. But the personal income tax is quite large, and the tariffs wouldn't be nearly in the same category. But even if it were a trade-off of a lower personal income tax for tariffs, I might be open. I don't think taxes are good in any form, and I don't like taxing trade. But the personal income tax is a tax on all consumption and production, and so it's not a good idea for the economy either. But there's a lot of craziness going on with this. But the only thing that will get people back in line with understanding the effects of tariffs is if they precipitate a catastrophe. And if he puts a 25% tariff on all Canadian goods and all Mexican goods, I think you will see a catastrophe. I think you'll see a recession. You'll see dramatic rise in prices in the goods that are protected, as well as the goods that have retaliatory tariffs on. And I don't want to see that, but I am worried that that could happen.
Yeah, I certainly don't think anyone wants to see that. We are chatting with Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky. Senator, I know we only have a couple of minutes left here, but I want to squeeze in one more thing if I can before we let you go. Gain of function research, particularly as it relates to what the U.S. has funded and how that relates to the potential origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, this is something the Trump administration seems interested in possibly having a pause on gain of function research. Is that pause going to work? I know there have been other attempts to kind of constrain that sort of research. Do you have any reason to think that this will be different or more effective than before? And do you think the Trump administration is going to be more transparent and more forthcoming about just trying to get to the bottom of the origins of COVID in the first place?
Yeah, we've issued 14 subpoenas to 14 different agencies looking for evidence concerning the U.S. funding of the research in Wuhan, who approved it, why it didn't go to the safety committee, et cetera. I think we're going to get that. As far as trying to prevent something like this from happening again, we have legislation called the Risky Research Review Act, and we passed it last time with bipartisan support out of our committee, but we didn't get a full floor vote. We're hoping to pass that. And instead of a ban, what it would be is the president appoints 9 different scientists, and there's different parameters and different viruses that are part of a select list. And any research done with gain of function would have to go before this committee. I think it's better than an outright ban because I'm open-minded enough to say, well, maybe they could have some research that might be worth doing. I think it's unlikely. I think most gain of function is simply dangerous without any great benefits from it. No vaccine's ever been made through gain of function research, and typically I think it is too dangerous to be performed. But I think having a committee is a better way to do it, a committee of scientists outside the bureaucracy. They would not be scientists that get NIH grants. The problem under Fauci was that basically he would appoint people who agreed with him that there was no problem with his research, and then you'd get more research grants if you voted the way he wanted you to vote. And so it's a bad situation. But I'm hopeful with this administration, we're going to do much better.
Well, we really appreciate your time, Senator. Thank you so much for your thoughts on these important topics. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is Senator Rand Paul. He is a Republican senator from the state of Kentucky. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bame.
Leading through the principles of conservatism can help more people achieve their American dream. We get details from Emily Green of Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Last week, Pennsylvania leaders joined a small group of the nation's best grassroots activists at the Freedom Embassy, a bastion of liberty tucked away just 2 blocks from the Cannon House office building. There, they gathered to hear from a leader who sought to do something that even he himself thought required a prayer request: pass a budget resolution that would put the House in a position to pass the extension of President Trump's Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Then, just the following day, Speaker Mike Johnson led the conference to pass, albeit with a slim majority, the vehicle in which the chamber can extend provisions of the president's tax cuts. In a 217 to 215 vote, the House chamber sent a budget reconciliation that sets up the American people to keep the tax reform that we've enjoyed since 2017. Speaker Mike Johnson may have only been elected by his colleagues to serve in the role in 2023, but since he was elected in 2017 to Congress, he's preached a set of principles that he's aptly titled the 7 Core Principles of Conservatism. They read as follows. First is individual freedom, the quote, unalienable rights to life, liberty, conscience, free speech, free exercise of religion, and the ability to pursue happiness, own property, build wealth, and defend ourselves. Next is limited government, where, quote, legitimate government operates only by the consent of the governed. Next is the rule of law. Then peace through strength. Next, and near and dear to Americans for Prosperity's heart, is fiscal responsibility. Congress has a, quote, moral and constitutional duty to solve the spending crisis. Then there's the free markets, where, quote, innovation, improvement, and economic expansion are at the forefront of our businesses. Finally, there's human dignity, quote, because all men are created equal and in the image of God, every human life has an inestimable dignity and value. At Americans for Prosperity, we can't agree more with the speaker's commitment to limiting the size and scope of government so that each individual can live their version of the American dream. With respect to fiscal responsibility, we've fought for decades to halt irresponsible levels of government spending and worked to support measures that protect taxpayers, eliminate waste, and promote better budgeting. We applaud the Speaker's leadership on passing the budget resolution last week that will ensure Pennsylvanians don't face tax hikes of up to $2,400 per family. Additionally, we thank every Republican member of Pennsylvania's delegation for voting to support the vehicle in which Congress will pass tax cut extensions. Taxpayers across the Commonwealth know how to spend their money much better than the government can. We need to continue to keep the grassroots pressure going to make sure the president's tax cut provisions make it through the finish line this calendar year. Join us in the fight. Talk with your member of Congress. Make sure that they know you stand behind them in the movement to restore fiscal prosperity for taxpayers across all income levels. Head to protectprosperity.com, a project of Americans for Prosperity, to learn more. Again, that's protectprosperity.com. This is Emily Green, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. And it is time to talk about the annual Pennsylvania Leadership Conference. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the premier gathering of conservative activists each year here in the Keystone State. This year's Pennsylvania Leadership Conference will be held April 3rd through 5th. At the Penn Harris Convention Center in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania. Featured dinner speaker will be Kayleigh McEnany, who served as Donald Trump's first White House press secretary. She currently is co-host of Outnumbered on the Fox News Channel. Additional speakers will include John Gizzi of Newsmax, U.S. Senator David McCormick, Congressman Chip Roy, along with Steve Moore and Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council. The conference will include additional speeches, panel presentations, workshops, and social events. Complete information and registration for the conservative event of the year, the 2025 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, can be found at paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. We'll be right back.
Thank you.